Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll give you determine what the future will bring. And let me sort of give you an example of the illusion we have today. It was about 3 or 4 years ago when Congress voted that we would build a fence along the entire southern border of the United States to stop illegal immigration, to stop the possibility of terrorists from coming into the country, of drugs coming in, of money coming in across the border. We're going to build a fence. And Congress voted for it. It was supposed to be completed in the year 2009. And so, of course, the Bush administration, though, as we know, of course, they were totally patriotic. They didn't want to destroy our nation through immigration. So they set out to build a fence, a virtual fence made up of watchtowers and sensors. And they gave $600 million to Boeing, and Boeing, which of course participated in our space program, was able to build magnificent airplanes and launch missiles into space. But they guaranteed they could build a virtual fence that would keep out intruders. But they never were able to get the thing to work. How could they be so incompetent unintentionally? And then, of course, you know, we ask, why didn't they just go ahead and build a fence? I mean, it would be a lot cheaper than building a virtual fence with all the fancy electronics. Oh, we couldn't do that. You know, it might not work. No, we want to have a high-tech fence. And so they ended up, they're supposed to be through in 2009. By the 2010, they had 28 miles of the fence up, and it didn't work. Now, let me point out, ladies and gentlemen, that in the year 2080, the Chinese were able to build the Great Wall of China to keep out the Mongol hordes, and that did work. It worked very efficiently. In fact, it caused the Mongols, instead of trying to attack China, they began to move westward because they couldn't get through the wall. But, of course, here in the year 2009, why we're incapable of building a wall. The communists could build a wall, almost 1,000 miles, at least 800 miles across Europe, and certainly in 1946, 1947. But we can't figure out how to build a wall. They were able to build a wall between Bangladesh and India. The Bangladeshis were smart enough to do it, but we are not smart enough to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. Do you honestly believe that they want to build a wall along our southern border, or is this all symbolism over substance? Are they trying to give the impression that we're trying to do something, or is the truth of the matter is it's all smoke and mirrors? They know exactly what they're doing, why they don't want to stop illegal immigration. They want to bring illegal immigrants in, first of all, to create a multicultural, multilingual society so they can play one group against another. That's why they've objected to English being our official language. Every effort to make English the official language has been blocked. And then, of course, they want to lower our living standards. They want to bring in cheap labor, lower living standards for the average American, but they can't tell the American people that that is the true objective and goal of the invisible government of the United States. No, we've got to appear to be bumbling idiots. Ladies and gentlemen, if they could build the Great Wall of China, 200 years after Christ was born, they could build a wall along our southern border today. Understand, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king, but in the battle for survival, it'll be reality, not illusion or delusion. Well, we have with us right now our special guest for the evening, John Quirk. Hi, John, how are you doing?
Stan, how you doing? I'm doing fine. Just back from the Mideast and all kinds of different things going on, as you know.
Well, that's why we were looking really forward to talking to you. I was just talking to one of my friends who got a lot of contacts in Sydney and Israel. He's an Israeli citizen who's here in the United States, and he's afraid that a war could break out between Israel and Sydney, Hezbollah, and Syria almost any day. Apparently, there's been a real increase in the tempo of violence in the Palestinians there, demonstrations all across Israel. We're not reading about it here, but apparently it's almost like a third intifada is breaking out. What word do you get? And then, of course, we want to know what's going on in the Middle East as well.
Well, you know, when you're talking about Israel, there is certainly a crisis between the United States and Israel, although both governments deny it. But if you read the Israeli blogs and if you read the lobbies of American Jewish organizations like the Israeli Project and some of the other ones, AIPAC, they're getting actually very, very hostile to the Obama administration. They're starting to single out you know, it's kind of a ridiculous assumption, but they're signaling out American Jews that are in the Obama administration and criticizing them for not supporting Israel. Today they listed Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, Dennis Ross, Martin Indyk. These are American Jews that are prominent in the Obama administration, and they're criticizing them for not supporting Israel. And, of course, this all goes back to Mr. Obama putting some distance between himself and the rhetoric of the Israelis regarding Iran and the Iranian position. So it's pretty bad all around. I mean, this is the type of things that leads to war. And the Syrians and Hezbollah in Lebanon believe the Israelis are trying to provoke an incident where the Israelis could eventually, even though there's a conflict with, say, Syria and Hezbollah, they could use that as an excuse to attack the Iranian nuclear facilities.
All right, fine. Well, just hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Our guest is John Quirk, and John spent many years with the intelligence agencies. He is working privately now, but we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is John Quirk, just back from the Middle East, just back from the Near East, visited both of them. John spent many years. How long were you with the intelligence agencies?
About 27 years.
All right, well, 27 years, and we are certainly glad he's out. He can at least give us some of the information. He has international connections, and he works internationally tracking down money that seems to have disappeared, and that's how he makes his living today. So he has a lot of contacts in the Middle East, just back from Dubai. And so he's going to bring us up to date with what's really going on, at least in the Middle East. Now, he's pointed out that suddenly there's a lot of tension building up in the Near East, which could very well lead to a war in the Near East. But what's going on as far as the Middle East is concerned and the possibility of an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear sites?
Well, all of the countries that I visited, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Oman, are extremely nervous and worried about a possible conflict between Israel and Iran. They're somewhat assured by the United States because we have a lot of troops in the area. We have naval bases and so on. And, you know, the feeling is that from Saudi Arabia to Kuwait to the Emirates and Oman, if it wasn't for the United States, Iran might have started something already. But they're very, very nervous about the possibility of a conflict blocking the Persian Gulf, as the Iranians like to have it called. I mean, it's called the Arabian Gulf. But if a war broke out, that narrow waterway, the Straits of Hormuz, would probably be blocked in some fashion or another. Most of them don't understand the American position. They're in a quandary about Mr. Obama. They seem to think Mr. Obama either doesn't care or is ignoring Israel. And in effect, if he doesn't care and is ignoring Israel, why is he ignoring the whole situation with Iran? Mrs. Clinton arrived in Russia, and she put up a mild protest, but the Russians went ahead and said, look it, they're going to build and operationally start the Bashar nuclear facility in Iran. It's ready to go, and they don't care. And then at the same time, the Russians are backing sanctions that the United States and Europe is advocating, not that they're going to do any good. But it's very evident that the United States and Europe believe that Iran is using this so-called nuclear peaceful use of nuclear energy as a mask for developing nuclear weapons. But at the same time, while we believe that and we advocate sanctions, Mr. Obama does not want to do anything militarily, either to support Israel or act on our own. He's relying on sanctions. And most of the people I know, whether it's the Saudis or the Emirates or Oman or people in Central Asia, Afghanistan, sources I have in NATO, the U.S. intelligence community, they don't believe sanctions are going to work. So the crisis is actually building more and more, and there's more and more pressure being put on Israel than any other country to do something about Iran.
Well, of course, we hear stories that there are people in Saudi Arabia, people along the countries along the Persian Gulf, Egypt, that would like to see Israel attack Iran because the Saudis and the others really fear the Shias who control Iran. They don't want them to have hegemony over that region. And there's a real conflict between the Sunnis and the Shias. In fact, many of them, they may not like Israel, but they really fear Iran. They'd like Israel maybe to do something and drag us in. Is there any truth to that?
Yes, it's very, very accurate what you're saying, because, you see, the Saudis are Sunnis. They don't like the Shia in Iran. The Egyptians don't like them. And there's also a lot of pressure that could be put on the Saudi government and Egyptian government to develop their own nuclear capabilities if Iran has it. In other words, the theory is going, look, India has nuclear weapons, Pakistan has nuclear weapons, why shouldn't Iran have nuclear weapons? And if that's the case, the Saudis would be under pressure to defend and develop their own nuclear capacity as well as the Egyptians. But it's a very, very bad situation. I think one thing that everybody finally agrees upon is that the Iranian government, the existing government, has no intention of backing down. A, they're going to continue to develop. They've listed something like 19 nuclear sites for peaceful energy. But most people believe that they are using that as a mask to develop nuclear weapons. The other big rumor that's going around is that because there's a move by young people, Mousavi and other people in the Iranian opposition, is that maybe Israel doesn't have to go after the nuclear plants, per se, within the next few months, but maybe they could possibly try to take out through assassination the president and prime minister of and the nomenclature that rules the Revolutionary Guard through assassination, thereby expanding the opposition's movement for regime change, and at the same time hopefully being able to position Israel and the West to negotiate with a new regime in Iran to downsize any of their nuclear ambitions. At least this is a rumor that's starting to float around that would be something short of Israel not attacking Iran.
Well, do you think it's realistic to think that we can actually depose the Iranian government simply by the negotiations, by demonstrations, or even by frank assassinations? Certainly, if Israel were to try to do that, why, of course, there could be serious repercussions as well.
Well, my own opinion, I think we're under a couple delusions in the West. One is that an assassination attempt through military action would not work. It might even unify the Iranian people. I mean, nothing unites a country like an outside aggressor, no matter what it is. It would also be kind of an international moral downplay against Israel, because there's a lot of negativity about the fact that I was in Dubai about the assassination of the Hamas leader by so-called Israeli agents or European Jews that were working with Israel. People just don't like that, and it's hurt Israel. I also think that the whole conundrum here, to use that word, is that it's a delusion to think that in the next year we can impose enough sanctions to change and bring down the regime. The regime is actually flourishing. I mean, even though the country is in bad shape economically, the sanctions have hurt the people. They haven't hurt the Revolutionary Guard. I mean, we've cut off their money, and we've tried to cut off their arms and their ability to buy secure satellite telephones and secure weapons and secure cell phones. But most of that stuff that the Revolutionary Guard gets anyway comes through Russia. We believe Russia lets it pass through to help them. They still get a lot of aid from China. And so I don't think we're going to see regime change in the next year. And in the next year, that's one area that all the intelligence agencies, finally in the West, Germany, America, NATO, France, Italy, Spain, as well as Israel, agree that Iran within a year will have two or three nuclear warheads that could be deployed. They finally agree on the dates, and the date is somewhere within the next 12 months that they'll have that capability. So I think, to answer your question, I think it's delusion to think we can affect regime change either by assassination or economic sanctions.
All right, fine. Well, now some people are talking about the fact that we're going to be moving a third, naval task force in there with aircraft carrier, third naval aircraft carrier into the Gulf, in the next month or two, and there were three naval task force in the Persian Gulf. That would be an ideal time for the war. Do you think there's any truth to that? We're talking about, I suppose, May or June. Or do you think it would certainly be put off, the war will be put off a lot longer than that?
I don't think Mr. Obama is going to issue any orders for our naval task force to go in. As you know, when Mr. Bush was president, there were anywhere from rotating maneuvers from anywhere from three to up to seven naval carrier groups in the area, meaning from the Persian Gulf all the way to Diego Garcia, where we have a base, where we lease it from the British. And we have other forces that stretch from Kuwait all the way down around the Persian Gulf to Oman and so on. Mr. Obama has ordered all of major carrier task forces out of the area. I mean, we do have some ships, destroyers. We have some Arleigh Burke destroyers. We have a couple cruisers going in and out. But most of our forces are land-based forces and Air Force-based forces in Diego Garcia. He's doing everything not to provoke the Iranians. So I don't see that happening at all. And people think, well, the United States is secretly going to back Israel and give them the nod. All you have to do is talk to a lot of Israelis and read the blogs to see that the United States, for all practical purposes, even though they issue some statements once in a while, is basically abandon the Israeli position.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with John Kirk. All right, John, so you feel that basically, the Israelis fear that America has abandoned their position. Would Israel act independently using either their cruise missiles or their 100 fighter planes to try to take out those Iranian sites? Or do you think that she'll hold off, you know, indefinitely if she's not going to have backing from the United States?
I think Israel is going to attack some of the facilities. I think at the same time they may also try to attack the leadership in Iran at the same time, instead of what I had mentioned previously, that they would try a separate, isolated attempt to attack the leadership in Iran. I think they could probably do both, but they won't probably do it through airplanes for a couple of reasons. One, Mr. Obama has refused to give them very specific encryption codes. He's reduced the number of bunker busters that it would take to eliminate this 53 or 54 serious nuclear sites in Iran. And the fallback is that everybody kind of agrees is that the Israelis would have to use their nuclear submarines. They have several kilo-class submarines equipped with sophisticated missiles, very, very accurate, that could take out the sites. The other reason is that they wouldn't use airplanes fully is that the Russians have now deployed their S-20 very sophisticated anti-aircraft missile batteries around the key positions in Tehran and the nuclear sites. They can apparently shoot down an Israeli, identify and shoot down an Israeli plane something like from 60 to 90 miles away. So
are those actually deployed? I mean, there's been some.
A couple are deployed and the rest are being deployed.
Okay.
Yes, there's two sites being deployed, and there's another 12 to 15 that are, I guess you'd call them, on back order. They haven't been deployed yet.
All right, because certainly Israel could not wait until all those were in place. Then it would be almost invulnerable as far as the planes are concerned. But doesn't Israel actually have some of the bunker buster bombs that we've given them in the past?
Yes, they were shipped some towards the, I think, last year or two, something like $25 to $50 million worth in the Bush administration. I don't know how many that gives them, but it's probably enough to take out the major sites. And there's a lot of rumors that the Iranians have shifted to one of their major sites where people thought they were there was the major weapons grade uranium area was in Bashir, where the Russians have helped them build a peaceful nuclear facility, to another completely new area. But I'm sure the Israeli intelligence services know where that's at. I think Israel at this stage, or probably within the next month, is formally going to give up on trying to negotiate any support from the Obama administration. And what that means is, in their own hierarchy, their own leadership in the Knesset and Netanyahu's government, that they'll probably all come to an agreement. They're arguing a little bit now.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and John's just saying that he thinks within the next month why the Israelis give up any thought that they're going to be able to change the Iranian position by negotiations and probably trying to arrive at a decision within the Knesset about, would you say, about whether Israel should actually go ahead and attack. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, I think what they're going to do is they're probably, in the next month, they will come to some agreement. They will come to the agreement that the United States is not going to give them either major help or minor help. They'll probably realize that the United States will give them some help if they are, in fact, attacked by Hezbollah or Syria or Iran, most likely Iran. But then they have to go ahead within the next month and a half and launch limited strikes against the major weapons research facilities in Iran that are developing, in the final stages of their centrifuges and the ability to create enough weapons-grade uranium to make warheads. And I think they feel that it's better that they do it now than wait in 3 months or 6 months or 9 months. I think they've given up on trying to convince Mr. Obama diplomatically that they really need his support. And this is quite a change from an American president, because going back to President Truman, every president has been very, very forceful in defending and giving military aid to, of all kinds, as everyone knows, to Israel. So the Israelis are not just in a quandary, they're kind of in a panic.
All right, fine. So you think maybe in the next couple of months that the strike might come. Now, what do you think Iran would do? Would Iran simply absorb the strike? Would she try to strike back at Israel? Would Iran, of course, feeling that perhaps the Sunni Muslims in Saudi Arabia and along the Persian Gulf are responsible, would Iran, do you think, then at that point try to close the Straits of Hormuz, or possibly attack the American troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, which would be totally irrational, but we're not necessarily dealing with rational people. How do you see this thing playing out? Or would Iran simply absorb the attack and simply let things lie there?
Well, the main issue for the Iranian regime is to stay in power. That's the most important thing, to stay in power. So I think they would probably assess it as something that would unify the country. It would probably undermine a lot of the moves for democratic reform. They're already cracking down on the opposition. An attack by Israel would probably undermine and outmaneuver what the Democrats, small d, want to do. So the Iranians may just embrace that and not do anything. I think if the attack was major, or the attack was against also the Revolutionary Guard, then Iran has a number of options. It could push Hezbollah to open attack as their proxy without them directly attacking Iran. It would bog down the Israelis. It would force the United States to come in with some support for Israel, some type of moral support, military aid, shipments. The United States probably would definitely go on alert, move its naval forces in to open and protect the Gulf. But you never know. This is how major regional wars start. One thing leads to another. One provocation leads to another. And then the Iranians do have several options. They could most likely attack the Saudi and Kuwaiti oil fields, attack possibly the ports going from Abu Dhabi all the way up to the border of Oman, which means Dubai, which would block the ports, which block the Persian Gulf, and in blocking it, inflict tremendous economic damage on the United States. Oil shipments to Japan would be interrupted. The Chinese aren't that worried, because they've anticipated this, and they have tremendous oil reserves that they've received from both Venezuela and Iran. So the Chinese would probably benefit more than anybody. The Japanese economy would probably tank. The American economy would not get over the recession that it's still in very much. I think today it's unlikely that they would attack American troops, because then the United States would come in full bore with Israel. The other thing is, the United States has trained about 600,000 Kurds. We have a Kurdish army up on the Iranian border, so it wouldn't really do the Revolutionary Guard or the regime to tangle with those Kurdish troops. So I think what Iran...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, yeah, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is John Quirk. Well, John, one of the things we've heard about is the fact that there seems to be a great deal of concern about the possibility of an Iranian attack on suddenly along the Saudi oil facilities along the coast there with ports where the oil is exported from, and then against the other countries along the Persian Gulf there. And we have been shipping then anti-missile systems to those countries that would be able to block the incoming Iranian missiles. Do you know if those missile sites are intact now, or are those missiles going to be delivered later?
No, we have a lot of them intact. More and more are coming in. And, you know, the whole area is a potential for an increase in war, because in the spring also the Iranians could send more supplies into Afghanistan to help the Taliban. The spring is not a friend to warfare in Afghanistan. So you've got Iran's machinations regarding Afghanistan could expand. But I think in summary what they would probably do is following. They would initiate Hezbollah to attack and have Syria support Hezbollah in Lebanon, attack Israel. Rocket attacks, if you look at rocket attacks, they're starting to increase by Hamas in Gaza. That would cause the Israelis more problems. And then the most important thing is the Iranians would have the option of blocking the Gulf. And that would be, even though we have missile batteries in Saudi Arabia, the sophistication of the Iranian Shabbat missiles are very, very accurate, and they have thousands of them. They could launch missiles from Iran and just isolate and hit the oil fields and refineries in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. That in itself would send...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, John is surmising that if there was an Israeli attack on Iran, that Iran might very well launch missiles and hit the oil fields in Saudi Arabia and certainly some of the other countries along the Gulf. And this would have serious effects on the economy in Europe. It'd have serious effects on our economy. It would and John didn't mention this, but of course it would help the largest oil exporter in the world today, which is Russia. I mean, that would be great for Russia. I mean, they've got lots of oil, and if the Iranians should attack Saudi Arabia, wouldn't that help the Russians economically?
Absolutely, and I don't trust the Russians. The Russians have been two-faced. They don't wish the United States well at all. They've been constantly denigrating Mrs. Clinton on her trip to ignoring her and ignoring their demands regarding Iran. And they Russians also see any problem between the United States and Israel, any problem between the United States and Iran would benefit them. It would accelerate problems that the United States would have in Afghanistan. The U.S. might lose face with both the Egyptians and the Saudis, as well as the Emirates and the rest of the Gulf states. And this would play into a larger global national security kind of goal of the Russians to give themselves a leg up against the United States. The Russian Prime Minister Putin announced when Secretary of State Clinton arrived in Russia that they're going to help Iran start up the one nuclear facility, and they're going to plan to help more, and nothing's up for discussion.
Because we're asking the Russians to suddenly impose sanctions on Iran, and Russia's saying, we're not going to do it. We're not going to go along with your program. Is that pretty much what they're saying?
Yeah, that's what they're saying, and they have a negotiating tactic because they know that the U.S. and Russia are in negotiations on a treaty to reduce long-range nuclear weapons, okay, which is it's to replace the Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty START. that expired in December, and they know that Obama is really pushing for that. As much as he's pushing for national health care in America, he wants that treaty. The Russians know it. So the Russians have a kind of an edge over us. They have an edge over us in several areas. A lot of people don't know this, but most of our shipments that go into Afghanistan are through Russia. Oil, supplies, weapons, and troops. The Russians, we pay them for it. We pay them exorbitant amounts of money. They could reduce that or shut that down any time and strangle us in Afghanistan. So they're in a tremendous position. They're helping the Iranians while at the same time they're being duplicitous and saying they're supporting sanctions. They're negotiating on the New START treaty with the United States because they know Obama has gone out of his way to say he really wants it. So they're positioning themselves over the next couple of years to be a major player again in foreign policy. And all of those things, I think, bode ill against the United States. So the U.S. is not in a good position. We're kind of overextended in Afghanistan. There's rumors that we may not bring the troops back in Iraq on that timetable. And the whole thing between Israel and the United States has gone sour over the issue of Iran. So all of these type of things, if you read history, can lead to a major war or certainly a regional war.
All right, because it just sounds like it's a powder keg over there, just waiting for somebody to light a fuse. Now, one of the things that really is concerned to me, you know, is the fact that Hezbollah said to have 85,000 missiles. Maybe it's only 45,000, but whatever they are, they're very sophisticated missiles. They got them from Syria, which got them from Iran, and these are first-class missiles. Whether it's 45,000 or 85,000 missiles, I mean, Israel's a little tiny country. You launch even 10,000 missiles on Israel, you could devastate Haifa, you could devastate, you know, Tel Aviv, you could devastate most of their cities over there. How could Israel possibly be able to withstand an attack by Hezbollah, much less, you know, if Syria should join in on this with her missiles, many of which probably have both chemical and biological warheads? How could Israel possibly survive even a couple of days of intense attack? Does Israel have an adequate anti-ballistic missile system?
Yeah, Israel is not worried, believe it or not, about Hezbollah. They know that Hezbollah not only has missiles, but in the last year has built up medical supplies, shelters, underground bunkers. There's more Iranian and rumors Russian and certainly Syrian military officers on the ground giving them aid and directional ability where to launch missiles. But Israel feels that they could handle both Hezbollah and Syria. And at the same time, they're negotiating, you know, the peace process is gradually, with the Mitchell plan, is gradually getting back on track. Israel isn't so much worried about that. Israel is more worried about Iran and their priorities. They're more worried about Iran getting a nuclear missile. I would say before that, they're worried about the so-called abandonment of the United States to Israel, although Vice President Biden was there reassuring them, Hillary Clinton's been there, Gates has been there reassuring them, but the level of paranoia that I see in the Israelis, and I talk to people in Israeli military intelligence, former intelligence, Air Force officers across the board, they're really angry, disgusted with the Obama administration. So that's a big problem for both the United States and Israel, because if there is a war, it would take a long time to get revved up to help Israel. They would need resupply of artillery shells, resupply of spare parts, aid, money, and so on and so forth. So it's a pretty, like you said, it's a powder keg. It's a pretty scary situation, and anything could set it off. Hezbollah, Iran, terrorism, Anything in that area could set off a major escalation of a war there.
Well, now, some people have suggested this whole issue of the 1,600 of homes is, you know, the fact that Biden comes over out of pledge undying American support for Israel, and then suddenly, you know, the Ministry of the Interior announces the 1,600 homes are going to be built in the Palestinian section of Jerusalem, and then Netanyahu says, gee, shucks, I didn't know anything about it, and Hillary is calling Netanyahu and yelling at him for 43 minutes, and then Netanyahu doesn't immediately respond or give sort of a vague answer, that this is all a cover to give the impression that there is a rift between the United States and Israel, and this is sort of a cover so we can say, oh, shucks, oh, we had no idea Israel was going to attack Iran. Why, we're not in any way responsible. We told them not to do it, and they did it anyway. But this is all a manufactured incident. Is that a possibility?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think we're that smart or that we could be that smart to engage in such a conspiracy. First of all, there's no construction going on. It's been approved, but it hasn't been executed. It's a threat. It's a scare tactic.
But it's not going to be done for 3 years at the most. I mean, why make a big incident? Why even announce something that's going to happen wouldn't happen for 3 years at a time when all it could do would be to create an incident? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think the real reason for it, and the construction hasn't started, like we just said, it hasn't started, it may not start, is that there's a perception by the Palestinians that Obama is pro-Arab, okay? And the peace talks have started. Mr. Mitchell is there. He's going to start shuttling. They're going to take 3 to 4 months. There's a lot of issues that have to be overcome. But there is an energy that Arab nations have, including the PLO and people in Gaza, people in Hezbollah, people all over, that Mr. Obama is pro-Arab. Now, I think it's a great exaggeration to say Mr. Obama is pro-Arab, but when people believe that, they immediately assume he's anti-Israel. There's a lot of blogs that came out yesterday and today that said the United States is trying to remove Netanyahu, okay? There's all kinds of conspiracy theories and rumors going around. But I think for the United States and the Israel to create a mask, it's just not that way. The traditional history has been very transparent. There's a lot of transparency from the Truman administration to the end of the Bush administration that the United States is completely committed to Israel. Mr. Obama has changed that paradigm. He's really changed it with his speech in Egypt, with his body language against Mr. Netanyahu when he kind of ignored him when he came here. He's made a couple, kind of half-hearted speeches. And even all of his advisors are very mute on the subject. I mean, you never hear Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, Dennis Ross, who's a negotiator in that part of the world, and Richard Holbrooke, who's supposed to be taking on certain parts of it, step up to the plate and defend the Obama administration in support of Israel. None of them are talking. They're kind of shut down. The National Security Council under Mr. Obama has not demonstrated that it's really going out of its way to support Israel. So I believe that in fact, is the case rather than some kind of trick or plan or mask that the United States is doing to support Israel. I think that there is a very, very lack of strong support and interest in not supporting Israel, but we do not support an Israeli attack against Iran. That's what the whole Obama administration is trying to send out to everybody.
Well, now, Is there a lot of concern on the people over there, the people you talk to in the Middle East, about the war and where this war might lead? Because, you know, you start a war and you never know how it's going to end up. I mean, it's a little short war, but then time and time again, people think that's the way it's going to go. And then we start a war and it keeps growing and increasing and more hatred and more blood and more calls for vengeance. And things can get out of hand, can't they?
I think they can get out of hand. And the one rumor that I hear, which is not from the Middle East, but it's in the United States, is that Mr. Obama honestly believes that a major conflict in that area, blocking the Gulf and accelerating any kind of war, could sink us more into a recession, that we're not coming out of the recession, that there's no signs that we're coming out of the recession. And if you block the Gulf and the stock market goes crazy because oil is denied Japan and the United States, people panic. And instead of, like most wars, really stimulating the economy, he's not positioning us for a war. And if there is a conflict and it expands, it could really damage us. One thing that's uniform that I saw both in Europe, and I was all over Europe, I was in France and Belgium and Switzerland and Liechtenstein and the Mideast, is that the banks are not loaning money here. And there's more unemployment. There's no credit. There's no cash. People need a lot of money to be able to even buy an automobile. Small businesses in Europe cannot borrow money. Small businesses in America cannot borrow money. Dubai has taken a big hit. The Emirates, Saudi Arabia, the recession is affecting all of them. All a war, and the Iranians are very perceptive on this, if there is a war, an extended war, or an attack between Israel and Iran, I think it's going to send us into a very, very deep recession. It's not going to stimulate economies. There's not going to be government spending overnight like there was in World War II that got us out of the Depression. I don't think a war in the Middle East will get us out of the recession. I think it'll sink us more into a recession. And I don't know about you, but there's not a lot of positive signs that Europe or the United States is coming out of the recession.
Well, if there is a war and we should get into it, no matter how much we got into it, how would we possibly afford it? Certainly, I mean, we're already having to borrow $4 to $5 billion a day just to pay our bills. What would happen if China and Japan just quit buying American debt? Some people say they're already, cutting back on American debt, and the Fed is actually secretly monetizing the debt. We're buying our own debt and of course that's a very dangerous thing to do. That's what they did in Zimbabwe and the Weimar Republic to try to stay afloat. Couldn't we get into real economic problems? Certainly, if we were to expand the war over there, or our economy were to contract even further.
Well, to paraphrase Donald Trump, who said it yesterday, we have two very serious issues. One is China, and one is OPEC. And a war in the Middle East would affect both of those. One, the Chinese could cut us off because we're already borrowing lots of money to fund Iraq and Afghanistan. It's kind of ironic that the Chinese are funding us to do that. And at the same time, the relationships of the Wall Street with oil, every time Wall Street shows a little increase, oil prices go up. So just think what oil prices would be if the Persian Gulf is blocked, and our reserves would be in jeopardy. The Chinese could cut off our funding. OPEC would not help us at all because the Saudis would be strangled like the Kuwaitis. The Venezuelans would certainly do everything to damage us. They're already in bed with both the Russians and the Iranians and the Chinese. So a lot of these countries, I think if there's a conspiracy, I think it's a conspiracy to finally damage us even more economically. We're bogged down financially. We've committed to Afghanistan. We're committed to Iraq. We've got troops and facilities in about 80 countries. And I think Mr. Obama understands this. This is one thing in his favor. He sees that if we get more involved in supporting Israel against Iran, it'll drive our economy deeper in the red.
And, Chris, there's no better way to destroy a nation than, of course, economically destroy the value of its currency to debase the currency. Is a wonderful way to destroy a nation. And as Alan Greenspan said in his book, The Age of Turbulence, not one person in a million would understand what's going on. We'll be right back here in a moment with John Quirk to finish up this evening's program. Well, John, it's been a fascinating hour. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us. I wish we could go on, but unfortunately, time restraints prevent that. But you've got 3 minutes and would like your thoughts, your parting thoughts for our listeners across America.
Well, I think Mr. Obama's administration is the first administration that I've been able to see. I'm a professor of national security studies in France, and I've written a number of books, and I've studied national security for 25 years. He's the first American president that I see that really isn't interested in national security. He spends most of his time focusing on this health care. He's delayed his trip to Asia. He doesn't seem to be, you know, he's not been able to deliver on his promises to the left to shut down Guantanamo, to accelerate our troops out of Iraq. Everything he's doing regarding Israel, the crisis with Israel, seems to me to say that he's really not interested in foreign affairs or national security issues. He's interested in a few things like a new agreement with the Russians, but he doesn't seem to really follow up or be interested in major issues of national security. And that bothers me because while we do have to take care of domestic issues, we live in an, you know, interrelated world between domestic issues and foreign national security issues. And I would think that somebody in his administration should wake up and say, look, we've got very serious problems with Russia, with Iran, with Venezuela, and we have to move for regime change in Iran and Venezuela, for instance, and be a little tougher with the Russians, and at the same time get along with the Chinese because they're supporting us. So that's a big concern I have. I'm kind of worried and in a panic myself about his conduct and his administration's conduct in national security affairs. So I think over the next few months, a lot of those issues will be taken out of his control and our control, and they'll be put in the hands of Israel, Iran, and Russia without the United States being the preeminent diplomat, negotiator, or military strongman that we need.
All right. Well, John, I really appreciate your being with us. It's been a fascinating program, and I share your concern. I think that we're sitting on a powder keg over there. I think that the average American has no grasp of the idea how serious the situation is, and I appreciate your help. Hope we can get you on another program soon.
Okay, all the best. Thank you. God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, off-air, John was basically saying that he thinks within the next couple of months the situation is going to move out of our control. Well, the determinant of what happens as far as the explosive condition in the Near East and the Middle East is going to be determined by Israel, by Iran, by the Russians, and we are going to be certainly dragged into whatever takes place. Now, we wanted you to hear John's ideas because I think that he has an excellent view of this, but of course we want you to hear all the other ideas as well. But the one thing in common between all of the people we're interviewing now who are knowledgeable, have ties to intelligence, or simply other ties, is that, is Avi Lifkin ties to Israeli intelligence, and certainly Ray McGovern ties to the CIA, which John has had them throughout the years. But the one thing everybody agrees, that there's going to be a war in the Near East and in the Middle East, and probably much sooner than later. The average American has no idea the implications this would have as far as destroying our economy, destroying the economy of Europe, and certainly helping Russia, because, of course, if the Iranians were to retaliate against the Saudis, and believe me, the Saudis want Israel to attack Iran, because the conflict between the Shia Muslims and the Sunni Muslims, and nobody's talking about that. It's one of the major driving forces. You will certainly want to get our newsletter. Well, that'll be coming out before long, but we're just going to get our latest newsletter. That's the January newsletter. The February newsletter really deals with a lot of this, and of course you'll hear it discussed here in our programs. Perhaps we can put together a four-tape set that will dramatize and let you understand what's really going on behind the scenes. But we hope you'll be listening every day. Now remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927, if you're in a position to help us, as we reach out on our 60 stations across America, trying, like Paul Revere, to sound the alarm. You can join the Radio Liberty family by calling 1-800-544-8927 or go to our website at radioliberty.com. We have a PayPal button there on our website. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, because if you look at the issues as they're presented from a geopolitical point of view, a lot of this just doesn't make sense. Not unless you understand the spiritual forces at work behind the scenes that are manipulating us into a major war in the Near East. And so you need to get Brotherhood of Darkness, my talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus that goes with that, my talk on the financial Armageddon to show you how they created this whole economic situation, and the syllabus goes with that. Of course, you need to get the Global Biodiversity Assessment, which is contained in our Sustainable Development Syllabus, at least the summary of it, the Earth Charter, certainly Agenda 21, to understand these people want to destroy the economy of our nation and impoverish our people. And that's laid out in the Earth Charter, written by Stephen Rockefeller. David Rockefeller's nephew. And if you don't believe that there's a secret cabal out there working behind the scenes to create a new international order, you need to read page 405 of David Rockefeller's memoirs. Have you read it? Have you checked it to find out if I'm telling you the truth? We carry David Rockefeller's memoirs. You need to get the information. You need to help us get it out across America. It's not what I say, it's what they say. It's about what they say about equitable distribution of wealth between nations, about a secret cabal aimed at creating a new international order and working against the best interests of the United States. Page 405 of memoirs by David Rockefeller. Certainly you need to get the three DVD set on the secret mysteries. Understand the secret societies that have been here since the inception of mankind. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty.